Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy. What's that? No city? Well, she's just not here for the intro. She's in the actual episode. She just didn't do this part. We got a really exciting episode for you. We got John Green as our interview guest. He's going to be talking to us about this massive TB initiative he has going right now and how you, by buying the products that you love, can help get involved. It's a great conversation. I look forward to sharing it with you right now. Our guest today on Sawbones, as we probably said, is John Green, here to talk about Good Dot Store. Is that the preferred Good Dot Store? That's what you said in a recent video. So I want to make sure that's the preferred nomenclature. I love
it. Yeah, we go with Good Dot Store.
Good Dot Store. That gets the URL right in the company name, which I love that.
Yeah. So Good Dot Store is our coffee, tea, and sock company that where all the money goes to support better tuberculosis care. And we're going to talk about tuberculosis today, my favorite disease. I mean, my least favorite disease.
It's Sydney struggles with that, too. She's got favorite viruses, favorite really dangerous stuff.
Well, everybody always asks a common question when you're a doctor is, what made you want to be a doctor? And I always say, ooh, hemorrhagic fevers. I just love them. And that's not a good – most people don't take that well. So I understand. Yeah. I empathize.
I don't love a hemorrhagic fever myself. and I don't love tuberculosis either. I really dislike it. And I think it's my unique dislike of it that makes it so interesting to me.
When did it really tick you off the most, John? When did TB really get on your bad side?
So I didn't even know that tuberculosis was still a thing. I thought it was like the thing that killed John Keats, you know, like a past tense disease, until 2019 when I was at a TB hospital in Sierra Leone. And I met this kid who has the same name as my son, Henry. And he was just one of these kids who just pulls you around the hospital and like chats to you. And even if you don't mutually understand each other all the time, he's just like there for you, like walking you through everything, telling you what the deal is with tuberculosis, showing you the microscopes that they're looking at the slides in and everything. And at the end of it, I was like, whose kid is that? Is that like a doctor's kid or something? And they were like, no, that's one of the drug-resistant TB patients we're really worried about. And in the end, Henry would go through like 6 years of treatment total. He would take over 25,000 pills over the course of his treatment for tuberculosis, but he did get cured. And today he's a student at the University of Sierra Leone.
Fantastic. Wow.
Unfortunately, he's studying human resources management.
Oh, that's a bummer. You hate to hear.
Yeah.
You hate to hear it.
Yeah. Other than that, he's doing great. No, he's doing awesome.
So what was it about this disease specifically? You kind of joked about it being your favorite disease, but is there anything else about it that stands? I do, as a layman myself who has talked about TB a good amount on this show, there's still like a residual Old West romance to TB, if that's fair, I don't know.
Absolutely. It's almost like there's two diseases, and y'all have talked about this to some extent on the show before, but like before the era of tuberculosis, this era of consumption, which lasted really until 1882, you had this disease that was really romanticized, that was the Old West disease, that was a beautiful disease that kind of made you sexy and also a little bit of an artistic genius. And like,
right.
One of my favorite lines about TB is some friends of Victor Hugo telling him that he would have been a great novelist if only he'd contracted consumption. And that was the disease you know, that was this inherited condition that came along with other aspects of a personality that made you such a genius and so beautiful and everything. And then in 1882, we discovered, oh, actually, this is an infectious disease caused by a bacterium, and it immediately becomes a disease of filth, a disease of poverty, a disease that's associated, that's stigmatized instead of romanticized. And that shift fascinates me. But then also, TB remains the deadliest infectious disease in the world, even though it's been curable since the 1950s, which is insane, mm-hmm. right? Like, it is insane to live in a world where the deadliest disease is curable.
It's also an interesting example, Sid, of how, like, we've talked about a lot, how important it is, the framing of a disease, like how we think about it, how mm-hmm. we talk about it. I know you were doing an awareness campaign recently about this, John, about TB, and I feel like the way we think about a disease is really important.
And I think that's true. It's something I encounter a lot in medical education, the way that I was taught about diseases and the way that we continue to talk about them, at least in the U.S. I went to a U.S. medical school. TB was, I'm sure we did a chapter on it, and then we skated past it because, for the most part, we weren't expected to encounter it or, I guess, to think about it or worry about it very much. The first case of tuberculosis that I, and since then I've seen more in the U.S., but the first case that I actually helped manage, I was working overseas in a village, Ekwendeni in Malawi, and they put a chest x-ray up and said, all right, doctor, what's that? And it was, they knew what they were doing to me. And I said, it looks like cancer. I thought it was a malignancy. And they all said, yeah, that's what all the Americans say. No, this is tuberculosis.
Mm.
And that was the first time I'd ever really seen a chest x-ray to even know what I was looking at. But right. I do. I think that there are certain diseases that even in medical school, they're like, but you don't need to think about this, which is kind of our privilege showing through our education.
Yeah, and to some extent, you know, the TB person in Indiana sends out pens to all the doctors that say, think of TB, mm-hmm. because, there are 10,000 cases in the U.S. every year. And like you said, you've seen some of it. But that's nothing compared to what it is in a place like Malawi, which is one of the epicenters of the global TB crisis, where you see chest x-rays that are terrifying on a pretty regular basis. It's funny you should mention that you thought it was a malignancy, because one of my TB friends, Dr. Jen Furin, described for me once that she, you know, from a chest x-ray was having trouble telling if it was TB or cancer, and that it proved to be TB. And when she told the patient started crying. And Dr. Furin said, why are you upset? We can cure this. And the patient said, it's so much more humiliating than having cancer. Like, that's how stigmatized TB is in many poor countries.
And I think we underestimate the degree to which stigma can be its own. I encounter this not so much with my current patient population with tuberculosis, although I do see that, because most of my patients now have HIV or at risk for HIV. So that's a lot of the care that I do now. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing, transportation and cost of medications. There's so many things that we are overcoming because of where I live and where I practice. But that last barrier of stigma is still, I don't have the tools or all of the ways to overcome just that to get people the medicine that they need.
Well, in HIV, the kind of twin pandemics of HIV and TB, for those who don't know, people with HIV have, untreated HIV at least, have vastly reduced immune systems. Their immune systems aren't as effective, and then tuberculosis can kind of much easier take hold. Like, a lot of people have been infected with TB, like between a quarter and a third of all humans right now have been infected with TB. But like, the vast majority of us will never get sick because we have an effective immune system to kind of control that infection. But with people with HIV, that can change really quickly and really catastrophically. And so we often talk about like the twin pandemics, because the HIV pandemic really reignited the tuberculosis, the old ancient tuberculosis pandemic. That's stigma is the hardest thing to, I don't know how to manage it either. I don't know how to get past a social order that just rejects people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's at the TB hospital in Sierra Leone, one of the nurses told me that the hardest part of her job is burying the patients for the families who won't come get their loved ones because they're scared. They're that scared of TB.
I really feel bad about complaining about Best Buy now. In hindsight, that was not a bad place to work at all. I don't know why I even had any complaints.
I feel the same way about Steak and Shake, man.
I mean, right? Like, you know, that's the tough thing at the office for me is like, nobody bought Netflix, you know?
I had a brutal graveyard shift at Steak and Shake, but I don't get to complain to nurses and doctors.
It doesn't stop Justin.
No. It's important because that my
as a doctor, he complains to me all the time.
I'm relieved to hear that. I'm really relieved to hear that because I don't think I could. Like my wife is an art curator, so I feel like I can complain to her, but I don't feel like I could complain to you. I feel like I'd be like, "How? What was rough about the office today? Oh man, it was so hard coming up with jokes with my brothers."
You know what, John, you're right. And the perseverance it takes for me to feel bad for myself day in and day out
is impressive.
It does not go unnoticed.
Beautiful, man. It's beautiful.
Thank you, man. Thank you. Game recognized game. when you talk about that starting point of saying, like, this is a problem. And I think that, especially in the U.S., in our medical system, which is so fundamentally broken, I think it's really hard to look at this giant system and say, okay, there is a massive problem. What size bite of this elephant am I going to, right? So I'm really interested in that. And I'm sure that is an absolute moving target and probably one of the biggest questions for Good Dot Store is what problems? What are we attacking? So how did you sort of like land on Lesotho for this like specific initiative and –
Yeah. So we started out tackling maternal health, trying to tackle maternal health in Sierra Leone. And, you know, that was actually that has been in an ongoing way really encouraging because Sierra Leone in 2017, one out of every 17 women were dying in pregnancy or childbirth. It was an astonishing, astonishing number. And that's been reduced by like 65% just in the last 7 years. Now, obviously, it has tremendously far to go, right? Like, it's still hundreds of times too high. But we're seeing, you know, this maternal center of excellence open up, partly funded by Good Dot Store, that's going to really transform. It's the first NICU that's going to be, for most Sierra Leoneans, the first really good maternal care center where you can expect a safe, clean OR, where there's a good blood bank, all that stuff that you really need to save people's lives when they're giving birth. That's opening up next year. We're really excited about that. But then Good Dot Store kept growing, especially the coffee and tea kept growing. And we reached out to friends in global health and we said, what would you do, you know, if you had a couple million dollars a year? And they said, we would invest in comprehensive tuberculosis care because it is curable, right? So you can end a chain of transmission by curing the person who's sick and offering preventative therapy to their close contacts. Like that ends that line of infection. And that's how we basically reduce TB to almost zero in the United States. Now, there is still quite a lot of TB in the US, but like compared to what it was 50 years ago, it's been reduced by over 99%. So, or at least 75 years ago from before the antibiotic era. So I really think like we know how to do this. We've just assumed that we can't do it in poor countries. And it's time in a place like Lesotho, which is a relatively small country, you know, it has a population of about 2 million. It also has the highest TB rate in the world. It's time to say in a place like Lesotho, like this is not acceptable. We don't have to accept this world. And so that's kind of what we're trying to do with our silly coffee.
Is there a temptation to just like crush one that's very local to you? Just like, I'm going to make a museum for me or, you know, like something that's a little more local, I guess would be the question.
There is a temptation sometimes because I think the advantage of local work, and y'all know this from your work, is that you're in the community every day. Right. And so you know the needs of the community in a way you don't know the needs of a community in Lesotho or Sierra Leone. The advantage to working in a country, if you trust experts, the advantage to working in a country like Lesotho or Sierra Leone is that you can make a huge difference. And you can make a huge difference with like what is a ton of money. You know, I think Good Store has given away $8 million in the last 3 years. It's a lot of money, but like it's also not a lot of money, right? Like it's not a lot of money compared to building Elon Musk trying to go to Mars or whatever.
Yeah, he should fix this stuff. sorry. Well,
he's so busy fixing other things. And by fixing, I mean breaking.
Yeah. Well, he's got to pay people to vote.
The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth.
What's
What's up, people of the world? It's Mark
and Hal, and we got this with Mark and Hal.
The show that settles those pointless arguments that you and your friends have. Should you put ketchup on a hot dog or liquid foam or bar soap?
And our 500th episode of We Got This with Mark and Hal is available now. It is supersized and a ton of fun.
Yeah, we've got guests coming back from the entire 500 episode run of our show. Some of your favorite Max Fun stars, some of your favorite regular out in other places in the world stars too, some really fun surprises, and every single one of them had a topic for us to cover.
You can listen to it right now on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, sleepyheads. Sleeping with Celebrities is your podcast pillow pal. We talk to remarkable people about unremarkable topics, all to help you slow down your brain and drift off to sleep. For instance, the remarkable actor Alan Tudyk.
You hand somebody a yardstick after they've shopped at your general store. The store's name is constantly in your heart because yardsticks become part of the family.
Sleeping with Celebrities, hosted by me, John Moe, on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Night-night.
So when you're looking at like different products and what that lineup is going to be, I know that Awesome Coffee Club, which I was a proud member, card-carrying member, is now Keats & Co. Is that correct?
Yeah, we rebranded. Yeah. We rebranded from the Awesome Coffee Club to Keats & Co. We wanted to get a little more TB focus, a little fancier.
This is the fancy. Okay, so this is
Keats & Co. sounds fancy.
This is the thing, John. You, as fellow brothers in entertainment, you and I both come from a long, proud heritage of being uncomfortable giving anything a cool name.
Yes.
I think that we are, by definition, we're pretty hardwired to not try to sound like we're ever being cool. So, it's like, it's a good sock. You get it. They're good socks. Just get them or don't. Yeah. We do good.
Yeah, just get them or don't. I think that's a key part of our
marketing
play as well.
It's an Awesome Coffee Club. It's like, you get it.
Yeah, yeah. But we rebranded to Keats & Co. in an attempt to be a little more mature. But it's still the same coffee, still the same price. And the major thing that changed is that our packaging got fancy. But I'm so uncomfortable being fancy, just like you.
Right.
Like there's that aging... I don't know. Some people say he's such a he's such an annoying cringe millennial, and I'm like, oh my god, thank you so much, because I'm pretty sure I'm a
Love
cringe
that.
Gen Xer.
Yeah, I'm right on the line there.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm right on the line. Y'all are a little younger than me, so I think you're safe.
I'm 43. I'm old.
I'm 47,
man.
Buddy.
It's impossible, John. You look 42.
I know. But thank you.
I noticed when you're the growth, you talked about the growth of Good.Store and the numbers that are continuing to build. It's such an the model of the company is so different. And it's
I should have mentioned that we give all of our profit to charity. So it's right. Like Newman's Own. Like right. We don't mm-hmm. keep any of the money.
Right. Now, I am astounded that you just did a Newman's Own poll and you're worried about being mistaken for a millennial. There's just no planet. There's no reality in which this salad dressing referencing man is a millennial.
You know Newman's Own. Yeah,
you
the
know.
Young people's salad dressing. You but know. They've given away hundreds of millions of dollars. They've done a ton of great work.
This is not to detract from Newman's Own. A lot of great products. Check my fridge.
I'm hearing you diss Newman's Own's delicious Oreo knockoffs, which are called Newman's O's.
I like Fig Newman's.
Fig Newman's.
Fig Newman's. They didn't even want to make them. They just came up with a name and they're like, got to.
I like the salsa. That's my favorite. If we're plugging Newman's Own products.
Okay, great. Now, who are we here for exactly?
Right, exactly. So my question is, how do you balance this is a question nonprofits have to deal with constantly, but this is not that exact model, right? How do you grow a business or balance growing a business with like doing the mission?
It's hard too because, well, part of the reason it's hard is because we have to invest in advertising and marketing, and every dollar you invest in advertising feels like a dollar that's not going to somebody in Lesotho.
Right.
And our advertising has to really be efficient because otherwise I feel sick to my stomach that I'm giving Instagram money and not getting enough money in return. So that's part of what's difficult about it. But I also think, you know, we try to treat it as a regular business. It's just a regular business that's trying to do something different in the world than accumulate wealth into two hands that already have plenty of it.
Right.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that, like, this is pretty easy for us to do because Hank and I already got paid.
Right.
Yeah, it's a luxury to be able to do this.
I think that that's, you know, it's so interesting to hear you say that, John, because I feel like when we do charitable stuff, I really don't ever find it laudable. Like, I really don't
right,
think of it. I don't.
Right.
I don't. I yeah. legitimately, mm-hmm. like, and that sounds like a fake thing, but I don't, especially when I feel like I'm just redirecting an overabundance of generosity. Like
I have said that for a long time because the majority of work that I do, well, up until soon, but up until now, the majority of work I do medically has been volunteer, so I don't get paid for any of the work. And anytime I'm applauded for that, I always feel like there are a lot of physicians I know who would also, it is a privilege to an extent. It does feel like a luxury to get
right.
to just practice this thing I love in its kind of purest form, just do it for the sake
right.
of wanting to do it. It is kind of a luxury. I understand that.
Yeah. And a lot of people would do that if they could.
Right.
You know? Right.
And the other thing is that there's a different kind of generosity involved. Like, I remember my first trip to Sierra Leone, there was this community health worker. Like, community health workers are really the backbone of a rural healthcare system in a lot
yes.
of ways. And these are the people who go out in their neighborhoods, visit with patients, those living with HIV, those living with tuberculosis, living, you know, people who are pregnant so that they can, you know, check in on them and get them maternal care as they need it. Like, that's the backbone of how a healthcare system like Sierra Leone's can get healthier and stronger. And I was visiting with this, but they don't get paid well. I mean, a lot of them don't get paid at all, but they don't get paid well even if they get paid. And I was walking around with this healthcare worker, Ruth, and she was visiting with a patient who hadn't taken her TB meds that day because she said she tried to take the first one. And you have to take like 10 pills a day or 15 pills a day a lot of times. She tried to take the first one and she just threw it up immediately because she hadn't had any food that day and she didn't have any money for food. And Ruth gave her like the equivalent of $2, just like gave it to her. And that is so much more generous than any amount of money that I will ever give because it materially affects Ruth's life. And I think that's really worth remembering. Like, I'm a little over celebrating rich people and naming buildings after them for their generosity when, like, they are not any less rich functionally.
Right. Yes.
And I think, you know, what you just talked about with community health workers, that kind of work that, again, I think even the way that I was trained in a U.S. medical school, we don't think about that as being applicable to our healthcare system.
Mm, that's so true.
But that exact work is what we are trying to build in my community right here where I practice because I live in a part of the country that is rural, where a lot of people are living in poverty, where a lot of people have no transportation, reduced access to everything, including education on these issues. There's a huge amount of stigma. And this is exactly I am sitting in rooms with people saying, maybe we need something like a community health worker. Maybe we need
yeah.
something like that to go door to door and figure out what people's needs are and help them meet them. We're trying to retrofit that back here because it is applicable here.
Well, Sydney, I think that's so important, and I think it's really important to understand that we tend to think of philanthropy as a one-way street, as like a one-way exchange of resources and information, that like we are trying to make the Sierra Leonean or the Lesothian healthcare system stronger. But in fact, we have so much to learn from the Sierra Leonean healthcare system, from how nurses and doctors and community health workers work with extremely limited resources to get different kinds of care to their patients
yes.
than we're getting to ours in the United States. And especially in a healthcare system that, as you said, is so fundamentally broken, those kind of interventions can make a huge, huge difference. So that's cool to hear, and it's really cool to think of this as an exchange of expertises and knowledges and learning rather than like a one-way street of resource distribution.
Yeah, it's wild to hear about you talk about the things that you used in like techniques that you learned in mm-hmm. Malawi
mm.
that you have had to like adapt for street medicine like at Harmony Health.
Mm-hmm. I also want to talk about how you helped take on Big Pharma.
Yeah,
which is,
in a small way.
Well, still.
That's the only way to do it.
That's very exciting and tackled the problem of evergreening, which I don't know if we've ever really talked about on our show or that our listeners are very familiar with.
Yeah, patent evergreening is an incredible strategy that pharmaceutical companies use to extend their patents basically forever. So they'll say, well, this patent is expiring, but there's this aspect of the drug delivery that we actually patented later. You know, at Doctors Without Borders, they compare it to you patent the pen, and then 8 years later, you patent the pen cap. And you say, like, oh, the pen doesn't work as well without a cap, so we're going to have another, we're going to have it for another 8 years. And then turns out 8 years after that, you patented a slightly better pen cap. And now
it's
that's
exactly
the
what
cap.
They've been doing with Mickey. Now they got the lines on the gloves.
Exactly.
So now
Mickey.
The ears are a little tilted.
Yeah. It's exactly what they're doing with Mickey. And so Johnson & Johnson was trying.
Thank you for saying that, John. It is exactly.
It is.
It's exactly.
Yeah. They do it with novels too. They want me to recopyright my novels so that like 74 years from now they can still make money from them. And I'm like, oh y'all, they will be so out of print. But anyway,
hey, by the way, John, 8 years till we get James Bond. By the way, if you want to collab with me on a James Bond novel, and it can't have anything but the name James Bond, and I think it could be a spy.
I'm interested.
2034, baby.
No, 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 shaken, not stirred martinis. But
no,
he can
guns.
Be.
No guns.
No Q. No, he can't be British.
He's a low-level insurance salesman in Muncie. Bond, James Bond, pleasure.
Yeah, and he can only drink gin. I love it. I'm in. Let's do it. But yeah, so this is a big strategy that pharmaceutical companies use, and Johnson & Johnson was trying to use it for their TB drug, bedaquiline, which is this incredible drug that has revolutionized our ability to cure multi-drug resistant tuberculosis and taken the amount of time that it takes to cure it, the amount of money that it takes to cure it, and brought it way down. But unfortunately, bedaquiline was still really expensive because it was under patent. And there were all these Indian drug manufacturers ready to go to make versions of it that were 60 or 70% cheaper, would expand access to millions more people over the next decade. And Johnson & Johnson was really reluctant to release their patents, but then under significant pressure from us and a lot of other people. I mean, I think this had been in the works for a long time. And to credit Johnson & Johnson, I think that they were really serious about this. They pretty much fully released the patent. And these days, you can buy bedaquiline for 70% less than you could even 2 years ago. And then the other company that we've taken on, which is a more challenging relationship, I would say, a more fraught, complex relationship, is with the company Danaher that makes the best tuberculosis test in the world. So they make this incredible test where after 2 hours, you can know not just if somebody has tuberculosis, but also whether or not their tuberculosis is resistant to common antibiotics that we use, the first line antibiotics we use. And that's a game changer to be able to know that from the outset. That would save somebody like Henry years and years of bad treatment. But the tests are so expensive that it's been really difficult. So we got those tests reduced in price by about 21%, which is a significant step, but we feel like there's some more work to do on that front.
That is that's an incredible triumph, though, with Johnson & Johnson to do that. And then I think that the point of care tests like that, those sort of rapid tests, I don't think that's well understood how critical those are, not just diagnostically, but to the access of care that follows up. We use a ton of rapid HIV tests.
Do you use GeneXpert? That's the company that Danaher runs.
Ours are Insti.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I think there's another group in town that uses those. But yes, we use the Insti, and having that and knowing that I have the patient right there, 5 minutes later, I have a pretty confirmed diagnosis. We'll send them off for blood work if we need to. And I can offer them care instantly. I usually have the meds. I can do it right there. They're so much more likely to access that care if I can do it in one place.
They can get started right away. And also, like, there's not that the delay. I mean, the delays doesn't just delay care in ways that can be catastrophic, because you can lose people. You know, it's so easy to lose people to follow up, or that's even that phrase kind of bothers me. But also just psychologically, it's really hard to go 3, 5 days, whatever, worrying about whether or not you're going to get diagnosed with something, and to be able to be with a doctor, to be able to, like, you know, have your questions answered immediately, like, that makes a big difference.
It does. It's huge. And we're trained that that's what we're supposed to do, but they're always, especially with tuberculosis, I mean, there's this lag where a lot of times we're doing the collect 3 morning sputums to AFB smears. And so it's at least 3 days if you can get them at the right time. And then you've got to get a pathologist to read them. I mean, it was a very arduous process. Even, you know, in the U.S.
Yeah, still diagnosing tuberculosis is way too hard and harder than it should be. And a big part of that is because Danaher won't make their prices more reasonable.
Is it, man, I think at this point in history, and you can say this at any time, but I think we're definitely seeing a lot of the evils of capitalism laid really, really bare. I mean, to like an obvious extent where like even a layman can look and be like, that doesn't seem right. How do you, I think of you as a pretty inspirational, humane thinker, John. How do you square for yourself as someone who wants to stay like, I don't know, engaged with the human race? How do you square the systemic evil with that individual, just like human to human thing? Because I still have the belief deep down that if you get individual people one-on-one, you can usually talk to them, at least begin to talk some sense. But I feel like they're working against a pretty evil system.
Yeah. And a lot of individuals are left out by those systems, and those systems oppress a lot of individuals, and then they lift others up. And the ones who are lifted up may not even sense that they're part of a system. You know, they may not even be aware of the system. They don't know that you have a tailwind until you turn around. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, but I think the place where I find hope, to be honest with you, is that human-built systems have human-built solutions, and they aren't easy. They aren't uncomplicated. It's extremely. I mean, Sydney knows this better than either of us. But like, it's extremely slow. It's human-to-human work. It happens at the scale of one individual speaking to one individual. But we can over time build systems that include more people, and we can find ways to reform our systems to make them better. You know, and they will still be wildly inadequate, right? Like, I think the ACA made healthcare more accessible to people, and yet still it was wildly inadequate. And we still live in a healthcare system that is hugely, hugely inequitable. And so I find hope in the idea that human-built systems have human-built solutions, human-built problems have human-built solutions. And ultimately in 2024, like, tuberculosis isn't really caused by a bacteria anymore, because we know how to kill the bacteria. We know how to deal with the bacteria. Tuberculosis is caused by us. Like, we're the cause of it. And that's very discouraging and very worrying. But that also means that we can be the cure. And that wasn't the case for people 200 years ago. They weren't in a situation where they could be the cure by changing the way that they distribute resources and changing the way that they allocate different cures to different people. And now we are in that world. And I think it's bad news in the sense that it's frustrating to live in a world where we are the problem, but it's also good news because it means that we know what the cure is.
And that's why Good.Store uses the tagline, if you shop anywhere else, you're the problem. And I just want to say that if I see you drinking any coffee that didn't come from Keith's & Co., you are basically on the side of tuberculosis. Like, I hope I'm not like overstating the point.
You're selling our coffee so much harder than I would.
I really
just saw this as an opportunity to come on my favorite podcast. You're really out there promoing me.
Well, John, I'm just so happy to have you, and it is one of those rare times where I can promote a brand that actually does good. I've done so much free work for brands that haven't given me a dime and are honestly actively evil.
That's part of that's part of their thing.
That's part of the gag. You can't feel good about anyone who's eating pizza rolls because of you.
I'm probably
honestly
wearing Arby's underwear like right now.
Yeah, I might add a pizza roll because of you. Actually, I might add a pizza bagel here and there.
You're welcome.
Mine is Diet Dr. Pepper. Like, I'm a very public fan of Diet Dr. Pepper. And like,
that's
I think
too.
I love Diet Dr. Pepper.
Can you?
Me too.
But okay. It definitely makes the world worse.
Oh, yeah.
Will you talk about, have you tried Dr. Pepper Zero Sugar?
Yeah.
It's better, right?
No.
No.
Okay, both of you two now.
It's worse.
It's not worse.
Justin made me do a blind taste test to see if I would admit if I drank them both. And then he said, now don't tell me what's what, tell me what's better. Yeah. And I know, one, like, I'm not going to know Diet Dr. Pepper.
It was a tough test. It wasn't a good scientific test. I agree.
It was better. It's Diet Dr. Pepper's better.
It just tastes better. And the other thing about Diet Dr. Pepper, and people think I'm crazy when I say this, but it tastes differently depending on where you drink it. So sometimes I'll go outside to have a crisp Diet Dr. Pepper because the outside air brings out the cherry flavor a little bit more. But then sometimes I'll want to be inside.
And,
exactly. Sometimes I'll want to be inside and taste more of the plum.
Well, and let's not
drink that Diet Dr. Pepper yet. I just opened that a few hours ago. You have to let it breathe.
We can't even get into the can versus the plastic bottle. I can't
the
even.
The can versus the decanter. It's the oldest debate. Yeah, what is the better?
Yeah. Yeah.
John, is there anything else you'd like to say about tuberculosis?
Yeah, well, I appreciate y'all's coverage of TB so much over the course of this podcast. It's like the least grisly thing you talk about. So I appreciate you guys occasionally going into non-grizzly spaces, but I also appreciate the grizzle, man. My son and I loved your amputation episode. Henry was just like, this is great. I was like, yeah, buddy. And he was like, they pull the meat over the bone. And I was like, that's right. That's right, buddy.
Right, I'm so glad he enjoyed it. Justin always, as we're recording, he plays the role of the audience for me sometimes, in that I'm watching his face, and as I'm talking, I'm thinking too far to pull it back. Because I don't have that line.
You don't have that line. No, they beat it out of you in medical school.
No.
John, thanks for joining us. Good Dot Store. Get your coffee. Get your socks. Get your soap. Tea. Get your tea. Get your coffee. Get your soap. Get your... Come on. Hey, and let me know if you want to do a line of energy drinks, because I feel like that's the partnership. Let me know about a smaller, much smaller, less important problem that I could fix with Justin's raw energy.
Justin's six-hour energy? Beat them at their own game. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported directly by you.